Star Trek, television's most enduring adventure. Enterprise, the first flagship of the Federation. These are her last voyages. These are the final episodes. Friday, a farewell.
Are you leaving because of me?
A hostage.
Kill me if you must. I won't assist you.
A spy.
You haven't told Archer.
And all are members of the Enterprise crew.
You betrayed everything that uniform stands for.
Transfer complete.
Hello and welcome to Subspace Transmissions, the podcast where two Trek fans step into the arena and tackle the best, worst, weirdest, wildest, and everything in between that Star Trek has to offer. I'm Cam Smith, and joining me on the bridge,
this is Tyler Orton, jumping warp fields like a badass.
And we're here this time to talk about the Enterprise two-parter, Affliction/Divergence.
Yeah, Cam, I was kind of dismissive of this episode as we were previewing it last week.
You really were.
And yeah. I have to say, really, the only terrible, and I mean terrible part of this episode, I think was maybe the last scene in sickbay. And we can get into that a little bit later on, the implications and what it means for Star Trek lore.
Sure.
But there's a lot to pick through from this episode and everything that's going on with the characters, as well as maybe some Star Trek retconning that never needed to happen in the first place.
Sure. Do you think maybe a little bit of that, thinking less of this one in retrospect, had to do with the fact that In the series run of season 4 of Enterprise, you know, you come off that Augments arc, and then you come off the Vulcan arc, and then this one feels maybe a little small in comparison?
I don't think it was so much of that. I think it's more just my memory of it being super silly, and for those that may not remember, this is really talking about the idea about why the Klingons look so different from the way that they do in Enterprise and TNG compared with the original series.
Right.
That's what I don't like about prequels sometimes, is when they're answering questions nobody asked.
I feel like a lot of people ask this, though. Don't you?
Sure. But you know what? By this time, it is a question, like, did we need an answer to it at this point?
Is it even possible to have a satisfying answer? Because, you know, I get it, like, I get why they want to explain it, right? For fans, it's kind of fun. It's a canon explanation for why TOS they look like that. But at the same time, in TOS, we only saw those Klingons. You know, I don't get the impression at the end of this two-parter, all the ridged Klingons are going to be gone.
Well, I'll tell you what the problem was. When we had like that fun nod to this different look in Trials and Tribulations, when Worf, you know, iconically said, "We do not discuss this with outsiders," I think that's all you needed. That was like a kind of a fun thing. But what the issue was, though, is that Enterprise came and had the, I guess, TNG era look for the Klingons.
Right.
And I think that's what really caused a lot of problems here. Like, then I guess at that point, you do have an obligation of some sort to go ahead and explain it. But I don't think until Manny Koto, the executive producer / showrunner, really took the reins in season 4, I don't think the creators ever had any intention on explaining this. It was just going to be one of those things that's leave it to the fans' imaginations to figure it out.
Totally. And I would be absolutely shocked if
when
they were developing Broken Bow, that there was any thought of, you know, maybe we should have them without ridges. I would be really surprised.
It may have popped up in someone's mind at some point, but I know what you're saying, because I think that because they're so iconic for how they look in TNG, it would have just been that much more confusing to audiences.
Plus, when you get to the TOS movies, they had the ridges. So it was more like even that
That works chronologically,
though. It does work chronologically, but it's almost like that particular property, that original series property, even acknowledging, well, this is what we want to do with money.
But there's still another problem with this, though. We have yet to be introduced to the mechanism that made the ridges kind of sprout up again.
Yeah.
And the other problem that we're seeing with Star Trek Discovery is that Discovery is a prequel to TOS.
Yeah.
And the Klingons have a very different look than they do in TNG as well, and a very different look than they have in TOS. And I guess this look is actually closer to the TNG look.
Mm-hmm.
So that creates other problems. It's a mess, Cam. Continuity with the Klingon look is a mess. I'm sure it can be. It's been justified in my head somehow, though, with different mutations triggering different things. And I think it is interesting in the very fact that there is a distinct look in between Enterprise, Discovery, TOS, and TNG. And I think if you work through it chronologically, I don't know, maybe it makes sense that like Klingons continue to experiment and they kept triggering different genetic mutations within that. And we eventually land where we do with the TNG era Klingons.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, that makes sense. I feel like with this Enterprise story, and we'll get into that story in a second, I feel like when it's all said and done, you can at least bridge it in your head. Like, okay, that makes sense as to how we got to TOS. Yeah, I got to do some leaping over some logical gaps there. But you know what? I'm okay with it. But yeah, Discovery really is the fly in the ointment where you go like, oh, boy, we didn't even have like a, you know, flat foreheaded Klingon in Discovery anywhere.
But if they never address it in Discovery, I don't really care.
I don't care either. I don't want to like continue this for decades further, just spinning around the drain trying to explain Klingons in the original series where they didn't have money for makeup.
Well, and then they also had the Kelvinverse look. That took place concurrently with the TOS era.
Yeah.
And then that was different. That was closer to the TNG look, except they had like piercings in their ridges. And Cam, it's a mess. It is just an utter mess. But it's kind of fun for fans to pick it apart. And I don't think we're nearly as down and negative on it as maybe a lot of fans out there who think, oh, you're ruining continuity by having all these different looks. I don't know. Think about it like a comic book, you know, like superheroes have different looks and styles.
Sure, different artists come on board.
Yeah. And like, maybe it's just plain old retconning. Maybe that's what it is. I don't know.
I mean, when I watch the original series, I don't really get too hung up about whether they have the ridges or not, especially when I'm watching an episode like Day of the Dove, where you have Kang. And he so much feels like the Klingons we would get going forward, the ones who have that real honor code. In my head, I look at him as a Klingon. I don't go, well, he doesn't have forehead ridges, so this isn't the same.
Yeah,
it's like he represents and embodies what a Klingon is to me, so I'm good with it. And yet, you know, I'll watch an episode of Discovery, mostly in season one, where you have a Klingon where they got the ridges, but I'm like, that doesn't feel like a Klingon to me. The ridges are almost beside the point to me. It's all kind of superficial. It's more about what they embody on screen through the performance and the writing.
It's funny because the TNG era Klingons, and point to somebody like Klang, or Kang, I should say, you know, is it just kind of that Viking sort of motif, that like almost that big warrior, jolly sort of warrior to a certain extent? Like, I think if you've got that vibe.
But also some pathos, too. Like, you can tell there's genuine, like they feel. Like, there's actual some, like, suffering and some kind of, like, that kind of wounded strength to them that they want to uphold this warrior code, but they're conflicted.
Yeah.
That's what really matters to me.
Well, we had an interesting episode a few weeks ago. We were talking about the evolution of the Vulcans. And one species I think we forgot to mention, I think down the road we'll do a Trill-centric evolution of the Trills.
Sure.
We've never done evolution of the Bajorans either, and I think that's one we can tackle. But
Vedic Borel in the house.
I know. Oh, I'm waiting for Shakar action.
We should have a face-off in that one.
Okay. Yeah, speaking of Klingon looks. so I just diverging off that, we were talking about how if we look at the Vulcans, you can really poke holes in what they are as a society, you know, and how there's a lot of facade going on. I think that's very true with the Klingons. You know, there's the sort of facade that they project or they want to project to other species. And then when you dig deeper in, you know that there's just a lot of hypocrisy within it all. And it's very interesting stuff. And we get a lot of that in this one, too.
Well, I mean, there's a reason that they've been able to mine decades worth of Klingon stories.
I know. Yeah.
You know,
so I'll float this to you, Cam. What do you think about the prospects of getting a new look for the Klingons going into, say, either the animated series, Lower Decks, or else maybe Star Trek Picard? Do you think it's just inevitable that we'll get yet another look for the Klingons?
Picard is going to be very interesting to me, more so than Lower Decks. I think Lower Decks will probably stick more with a little bit of the classic iconography of the Klingons.
Mm-hmm.
But Picard is interesting because it is coming out of the Kurtzman factory, who's done some drastic remodeling on the Klingons in Discovery. So I'm curious whether they carry that aesthetic over to Picard a little bit.
Yeah.
I mean, I think they'll keep it maybe more so closer to season two Discovery, where they represent or where they look a little more like the Klingons we know and love. But
don't they want to leave the door open for a Worf reappearance?
I know. And what is it like when you bring Worf back, but say he looks like a Discovery Klingon?
And I don't think they'll do that, though. Yeah. Like, I think what they need to do for Picard, I think they know they'll get in too much trouble if they kind of revamp the look too much. I think there will be kind of, you'll be able to tell the difference between kind of the makeup job done in the 1990s and the Berman era,
yeah,
versus the makeup of will be seen in, you know, circa 2020. It's going to be interesting, but I think they'll avoid showing the Klingons for as long as they can on, yeah, Star Trek Picard. I don't expect to see Worf in season one at all.
Right.
But I don't know.
Michael Dorn's at home like, oh.
Pretty much. So look, so much to dissect. Why don't we jump into this episode?
Yeah.
Because despite, you know, my reservations about it last week, I sat down and I was like, there's actually a lot of fun stuff going on here, especially when it comes down to the characters, though. What kind of jumped out to you going into this one?
I'd forgotten that this was the episode where Trip went over to the Columbia.
I forgot that too. Yeah.
And I really loved how, and this isn't tied to the Klingon stuff, so I'm already diverging from the actual Klingon storyline, but like, I liked that there was character motivated stuff going on. Like, I loved Trip going to the Columbia and having to deal with his relationship with T'Pol. I really loved, I'm not big on the Section 31 stuff on Enterprise. I think it was a little thin, but I did like what it did for the character of Malcolm Reed and introducing this conflict within him.
Yeah.
Because that's a character that was often, you know, shooting away on the bridge. You know, it tended to be he was a character who was sidelined unless they had thing like his, you know, his conflict with Stephen, what was the name?
Stephen
Culp's character. Yeah. No, Stephen Culp's character in season three.
Yeah.
In the Zindi War.
Major Hayes.
Yeah, Major Hayes. You had that. But then Hayes is gone, and so I like that this brought a little more of that back to Reed, where you actually got some character growth.
So between Hayes and Harris, it's guys that names start with H-A is really where Reed is at.
Yeah, you know? No kidding. Okay. Yeah,
yeah, you know, the Section 31 stuff, I think it gets dopier and dopier the more, you know, Star Trek delves into it, as yeah, we saw, I think, in Into Darkness as well as Discovery.
Yeah.
I think they should have just kept it as nondescript and mysterious as possible, which is what we got in Star Trek Deep Space Nine.
Yeah, and they're still doing that at this point in Enterprise as well. Like, we only really get Harris.
Yeah.
And he has shadowy, you know, things going on. That's enough.
Those are the Rigelians, Cam.
also in Shadows.
Yeah. I was watching that scene where they're kidnapped Phlox, who actually put up quite the fight against these Rigelian mercenaries.
He did, yeah.
Outside of a Chinese restaurant in San Francisco. That was interesting. Yeah. But yeah, at first I had forgotten it was Rigelians that had kidnapped them.
I'd forgotten that too.
I was like, wow, those Klingons are pretty bold, just like wearing hoods, walking around like San Francisco,
yeah,
and then speaking kind of weird English, you know?
Yeah, yeah.
But the other thing that was interesting, though, is that the Klingon doctor here, mm-hmm, he had also brought up the fact like, oh, I met you before, Phlox. I was disguised at that alien medical conference. So we're already picking up ideas like Klingons like to disguise themselves. We saw that with Arne Darvin. Then we saw that with Ash Tyler.
Yeah.
This goes back centuries and centuries. It's kind of interesting to pick up on that thread early on in chronology of Star Trek.
Should Star Trek have dropped that? Because we don't really get a lot of Klingon disguises post-Discovery time period. Post-TOS time period, I should say.
I think the only time that they bring it up again is on Star Trek Deep Space Nine with Trials and Tribulations and the return,
yeah,
of Arne Darvin. So maybe there's a change in Klingon society and they thought it was without honor to
maybe,
you know, do it. Or maybe they just looked at, hey, look, we had a lot of trouble with this Ash Tyler fella. This Arne Darvin turned out to be a real dope. You know, let's just stop doing this. This is not working out.
I guess we kind of got the reverse with Apocalypse Rising, where the DS9 guys dressed up like Klingons.
Yeah,
so
yeah,
we
yeah
did get that.
What do you think's like more fun? The idea of you know, Starfleet officers disguising themselves as Klingons, or Klingons trying to embed themselves within the Federation?
I think there's enough aliens that are better at like the covert stuff, like the Romulans, for example, or the Changelings, that I don't necessarily need it from the Klingons. Like, you know, some of the examples we've had worked, especially the Tribble stories, the Ash Tyler one, it's hit or miss.
Sure.
But it has its strengths. But I think it's more fun to see the characters go undercover as Klingons because, I mean, come on, it's like Avery Brooks and like Cole Meany playing Klingons. That's really fun to watch.
Yeah.
So
it would still be very difficult, though. I'm just thinking about the Universal Translator.
Yeah. Because
in the Discovery era, they're trying to kind of explain it by having like your voice going out in another language through the communicator.
Yeah.
And so I don't think that would work out so well if you're on an alien planet. Although, remember we were on Kronos in the season one finale of Discovery?
Yeah.
And yeah, there was a lot of speaking in Klingon there. But remember Clint Howard? He was speaking English too?
Yeah.
It was weird.
Yeah.
You know.
The universal translator is something that doesn't really make that much sense.
And guess what? I don't need a Star Trek episode, or a Star Trek two-parter, I should say, devoted to explaining all the intricacies of it. I'm just like, it's one of those things where I can just like make the leap in my brain, and that's totally good enough for me.
I don't need to see the actor's lips not matching the Klingon sounds coming out of them.
Yeah. So I was referencing the doctor here as played by John Shuck, and I think I, again, mistakenly said that was the J.G. Hertzler character. That was actually from a few seasons earlier.
He's in the Augments three-parter. He does pop up. Yeah, he's like the I believe he was like the captain on the Klingon ship that gets taken over by the Augments, and he's in it very briefly.
But was he not in an episode where he's playing a Klingon lawyer?
Yes, he was actually in season two, I think it is.
So I don't think that one was Sleeping Dogs. I think Sleeping Dogs was the one where they had the Klingon bird of prey like stuck in a gas giant or something.
I think it had like a legal-esque name, maybe like Judgment or something.
Okay.
Yeah.
Why is it like every single sort of like legal drama on TV has to have like a bad pun?
Yeah, no, it's true.
You know, what would be a great Star Trek bad pun for a legal sort of series?
Oh, God.
I'm putting you on the spot.
You really are. I got nothing.
Okay.
I'm racking my brain. Boy.
How about Warp Factor Gavel Time? I don't know. That's not even a pun. I don't know.
That's
what
about
that
as
is.
Good as I would have come up with.
Yeah. Yeah, I'm just mashing words together at this point. Sorry. Is gavel time something that they say in like courts?
Sure.
The judge says gavel time.
I like to think so. And then he turns his seat around.
So anyways, the reason I do bring this up, though, is because once again, the doctor, he makes reference to, you know, the warrior caste. And that was something that the J.G. Hertzler lawyer character had made reference to, is how, you know, there's artisans, there's lawyer caste and stuff. But within Klingon society, and I think this is important, they don't emphasize it enough. Not every Klingon is a warrior. It wouldn't work out, you know, to be a functional society. So that's why you need, you know, doctors who, guess what, not revered within Klingon society, but they do still have a function that's needed. And that's why they have to resort to these kinds of means, like disguising themselves to get information. Remember, they even stole that database that Fox wanted to access here, you know?
Right.
So it is interesting how kind of these cracks in Klingon society are further exposed once you go below the surface level that's often presented to our characters.
Yeah. Oh, totally. I really liked that. You know, this John Shuck character says to Phlox about how, you know, like, I'm a doctor, so I'm not really that looked upon kindly in my house, which is a warrior house. And Phlox is like, well, you did serve with, like, the Klingon military. Like, wouldn't that get you something? And he's like, no, I'm still deemed inferior.
And remember when we were getting to know Martok, like, he tried to get out into, I guess, like, be an officer within like the Klingon Empire, and because he was born into a lower house, he didn't he have to like mop the floors or like I think he was like assigned to kitchen duty or something like that. It's like not even like kind of a cannon fodder role or anything like that until he had to work and prove himself. So you see that like Klingon society, it's very it's not a meritocracy by any means.
It seems, you know? From the outside, very broken.
it does. And you kind of wonder how they've been able to continue functioning. And maybe it does make sense that there is a lot of, what's the word I'm looking for? But conniving within the higher ranks of the council and all that. It just seems...
You would have a lot of social climbing. You would have to, because, you know, we think of our own society and like the haves versus the have-nots. And... with Klingon society, how many are genuinely looked upon very highly? It seems like it's really the warrior classes. And what about all the rest?
Well, and that's what they said in Star Trek Discovery. There are 24 great houses.
Yeah.
So how many people are within any given house?
Exactly.
Like, there might be cadet branches of these noble houses or whatever, but I don't know. Are we talking about... I'll be generous here, maybe 10,000 Klingons?
And they're on how many planets?
Yeah, I know. So it's kind of like, they're, like, just a drop out of this ocean or kind of the nobility class that would be able to run things. It just seems like kind of a nightmarish thing. So it is kind of funny that there hasn't been more of a democratic uprising or
like a revolution in Klingon society. Maybe we'll see that in Picard.
Well, it's interesting because I remember Ronald D. Moore, like when he came on as kind of a writer, I think they wanted for early TNG, like season 3, 4, they wanted like a primer on like what made the Klingons Klingon. And so he kind of made something for the writing staff. And he had explained to it within this primer. It was never made canon or anything, but the idea was is that what the Klingons do with the Empire is they're able to protect them, ensure that trade between planets is able to function properly, and for that protection, that's why these planets are willing to go ahead and be part of this Klingon Empire. So I guess to a certain degree that the warrior class is doing their part, you know, it still bothers me that we've never seen any other aliens within this Klingon Empire, like not even at like a remote space station or colony or something like that there, because there's no way the Empire is almost the size of the Federation and there's only one species occupying all these planets. It makes no sense.
Yeah, it seems like a real missed opportunity. I'm actually shocked in the 700 plus hours of Star Trek they've never thought to do an episode about, you know, an alien species that is under the Klingon Empire.
Because we even got that with, say, the Dominion. We saw other Dominion species.
Yeah.
I think the closest we might get is there might be an opportunity in Star Trek Picard to showcase what's going on with the Romulan Star Empire following the fall of Romulus.
Yeah.
So, yeah, I'm intrigued by this, but I do like what we did with the Vulcan episode. We were kind of picking away at some of the cracks there, and I like exposing some of the cracks that they have within society as iconic as the Klingons, too.
And I have to believe, too, like, a lot of the Klingons we see on Star Trek are this warrior class, and a lot of them seem pretty ruthless. I have to believe, though, that in the larger body of Klingon society, it has to be somewhat more agreeable than what we see to these aliens that exist under their rule.
Yeah.
Because if it's all these, like, and like a lot of the time on Star Trek, the Klingons that are out there in the ships dealing with the Enterprise or whatever are a little bit, you know, dastardly in a lot of ways. And I have to believe there's a far more positive aspect to Klingon society in out, maybe outside these warrior classes out in the ships that are more agreeable to the people that live under them.
Because otherwise, just like we're saying, like how would this empire even continue to function as we know it? And I can buy the fact that just the ships are, you know, occupied by, you know, the warrior caste. Like I totally buy that, you know, and that's why our view of the Klingon is shaped the way that it is because that's generally what we see is our crews encountering these ships full of warriors. But I like it. I think Enterprise did the most to introduce us to these other castes, which is, you know, and by cast, I don't mean stars of a show, but
Scott Bakula.
The other one that jumps out to me, though, is do you remember that helper dude from House of Quark, who is Grilka's sort of like the facilitator, the older guy with like kind of the white beard?
Yeah.
And remember when Martok was made chancellor? Or no, was it me? Was it when he was like permanently posted to Deep Space Nine? And, well, as in like that's where his main base was going to be. I think Martok got like kind of a helper there for like paperwork and all that.
Right.
These are not warriors, you know? Right. So we do know that these kinds of Klingons do exist. It's just as viewers, I think we're both interested in kind of exploring that and why there's kind of this tolerance that each of these castes and different aliens within the Empire's must have for each other.
Oh, totally. Totally. And it's something that, I mean, boy, you could do a whole just Klingon series. And maybe in the world of streaming, that's something that may happen further down the road. I would never rule it out.
Would you want to watch a series or maybe like a mini series?
I'm thinking mini series. I'm becoming increasingly more won over by the world of like 6 to 8 episode series runs.
Yes.
So I am 100% down for that.
As am I.
Yeah.
Maybe continuing on with this story because there is some fun stuff with Tripp's replacement, Commander Kelby.
I love Kelby. Kelby is such a loser.
Where did they find this guy?
I know, because
he can't even answer the comm like within like 30 seconds, you know?
And I like that everything they need done, Kelby's just like, I can't do it.
Sorry, man.
And I mean, okay, Yes, Enterprise is the big flagship, but I would have to imagine Columbia, the second one out in space, is going to have a pretty crack team as well.
Yes.
Kelby's on this ship?
Well, exactly, because I'm guessing if Trip was going to go and stay on Enterprise, yeah, then that meant that the Columbia would have Kelby.
Yeah, I would think so. He must be in the upper ranks of people that would be joining these ships.
Although I like how Kelby looks to be like 30 and,
yeah,
and like, yeah, best engineer in the fleet. Like, okay.
I mean, I don't know. How old was Trip supposed to be in like the pilot?
Maybe 33. I don't know. Like, yeah, looked like a pretty young guy.
Yeah.
So that's kind of tough. Although I was looking up Dominic Keating's age. You and I were at a convention,
mm-hmm,
and we could not for the life of us figure out how old he was supposed to be based, right, on like stories he was telling from his childhood and,
yeah,
how like television was so scarce, like, growing, right, up, and I was like, what? Okay. He was about, so Dominic Keating was about 37, 38 when Enterprise began.
Oh, awesome. I'm now older than he was on that show.
There,
great,
you go. There,
I feel,
you go.
I feel wonderful.
Did you have a television growing up, Cam?
No. I built my own.
You acted it out inside like a cardboard box.
In like pantomime?
Yeah.
Yeah, yeah.
So we got Kelby here. It's a dopey character. The only thing that frustrates me from like a writing perspective is the character only exists to show us what an idiot he is, you
and
know?
Why Trip is awesome.
I know. I wish there were more layers to Kelby where maybe he would have bursts of brilliance or there is some value to this character. But as it stands, this character has zero value whatsoever. He's also like you said, he's like, sorry, Captain, can't do it.
Yeah.
Like, oh, can you try? Oh, man. Like, we all know that person at work.
I mean, it's fun to have a character like that just like make fun of, you know, like 10 years, 15 years after the show has aired, you know, now to still laugh about Kelby. But it would be more compelling from a TV point of view to have an engineer that we genuinely liked. So there was that dramatic push and pull of like, well, we want Trip back, but I like this character a lot, too.
Yeah.
Like, you would get much more of a sense of what it meant for Trip to come back.
Well, don't worry, Trip, he has access to one Ensign Seth MacFarlane over on the Columbia.
Seth MacFarlane, I have nothing against Seth MacFarlane. You know, I think he's often a very charismatic guy. And you can see how far he has come as an actor,
sure,
on like the Orville than versus his appearance on Enterprise, or boy, is he stiff.
He's doing his cosplay thing.
Yeah.
And it's also back when this episode aired. Like, it wasn't like Seth MacFarlane was this iconic, you know, household name where, like,
right,
people would instantly recognize him. I think it was mostly, like, he was friends with Brandon Braga. Brandon Braga put him in there as, like, a favor, even though it was Manny Cota's era. But I'm sure he can pull some strings. And that's what it was. So I don't think it was distracting at the time so much. But right, I watch this now, and I'm just like, okay.
Yeah.
They'd be watching, like, I don't know, let's say I'm watching Return of the Jedi, and then Patrick Stewart starts, like, wandering around in an Ewok costume or something.
That would be amazing.
Yeah. You know, just doing the Jumja song.
He's the one that jumps on the back of the speeder bike and then swings away on a vine.
It's just, he's got the Ewok body, but its head is all Patrick Stewart. Like, that might take me a little bit out of the moment going back and rewatching it now.
Beecher Wawa.
Thank you for that, Cam.
Yeah.
So, but of course, I did get a laugh when, you know, Trip was having dinner on the Columbia, and guess what, Cam? There was pecan pie.
Oh, I didn't notice that.
Oh, no.
No.
He was like, your chef sure gives our chef a run for his money because he's eating pecan pie.
Oh, I didn't even pick up on the pecan pie.
Every single cliche about Trip that they want to do. The other thing is Connor Trier, he's not even from the South.
Yeah.
He's from Washington State.
Yeah.
Like, that is hilarious to me that he's doing like this like accent that doesn't really exist at all, you know?
Yeah.
But that's why I'm not attacking. When I'm doing the Southern accent, I'm not making fun of it. I'm making fun of the fact that this accent does not exist.
Sure, right. So. And what did you think of Erica Hernandez in this episode?
I love her. Like, it's like we got her. Did we not see her, I think, in the episode Home?
Yeah.
She
goes climbing with Archer.
Yeah. She was like kind of a great character. They have a history together. We get her in this two-parter too. It's just like one of those kind of great characters that I just wish we had time to see even more, because a lot of times on Star Trek you meet other starship captains,
yes,
and they all suck,
yes,
and it just really emphasizes like how great your captain is that you're following on the series.
Yeah.
I would totally watch a NX-02 Columbia like spinoff series. Like that would be good.
Do you think had there been a season 5 Enterprise, we would have gotten more of the Columbia?
Well, if we're doing a Star Trek Romulan War sort of arc in season 5, yeah. I think we would have seen more of a fleet. You know, and so I think she would have been a big part of that going forward.
And they were very smart to say the Columbia is pretty much identical to the Enterprise, so then they could use all the same sets.
Although, okay, so that there were some subtle change, not so subtle changes to the bridge set there. Did you find it distracting, just the lights that were like blasting, like as the ship went to warp?
Not really. No, if that didn't jump out at me.
If I was sitting on that bridge, and they had like these giant light panels that were flashing just as it was going to warp, I would have that kind of strobing effect on me. Like I would be a little bit worried myself.
Yeah, oh yeah, totally.
The other thing I noticed, whether it's worth pointing out or not, is that opening shot of Columbia departing space dock.
Yeah, I love that. Yeah,
that was great. And then also when you go and pan to the bridge, you only see women on the bridge. That they don't do that very often in Star Trek, though.
No.
It's nobody blinks an eye if it's like a bridge full of men.
Yeah.
But I'm sure some people are like, why are you putting like women on the bridge? Trying to be two PC guys? And I'm just like, okay.
I guess we're getting close to that on Discovery. Fairly close.
Oh, yeah. Look, take Saru or... Well, are we getting? I think it's more like getting 50-50 though, because we've got Saru.
I guess Reese and Bryce. Yeah.
And there's one other person. Milton Richter. Like, hey, Cam.
Yeah.
I forgot to pitch this to you when we were doing our season 2 rewatch of Star Trek Discovery just the other week.
Okay.
You know how we were kind of like thinking it was kind of dopey that for that one episode that Gant.
Yeah.
Comron Gant returned.
Right,
it was some character who was in the background of the Shenzhou in the first episode that nobody remembered. It's just like, who cares?
Yeah, why wasn't it Milton Richter?
What I'm saying. It would have been even better just for us as like a dumb in joke. Like it was Milton Richter that returned after his departure, his unexplained departure from being part of the bridge crew in the first half of Discovery season 1.
Well, spoiler, he's joining one of the other spinoffs. He'll be the Section 31 actual lead.
I cannot wait for that. Yeah.
Michelle Yeoh is just keeping that one a secret. She's like, no, I'll still be supporting Milton Richter. It's his series.
Yeah. So it is funny, though. We're digging way more into kind of the character stuff that's going on the ship versus the actual kind of story elements of the Klingon stuff. We're very interested in, I guess, the implications of the Klingon storyline.
Yeah. Talking about part one right now.
Yeah.
And I mean, part one, it's in terms of the Klingon story, it's mostly all set up. It's explaining what Phlox is doing there.
It's us watching Phlox on a planet, and he has to watch people get experimented on. It's just kind of like, there's only so much for us to pick apart in that.
It is fun to get some of the background on the augment DNA and how this has, caused a virus. It's fun that, again, Manny Koto is playing connected dots in a fun way on Star Trek, in the way that DS9 did it as well, where there's ongoing continuity, but it's not as necessarily serialized as like a Discovery, where it's very like, the episodes kind of blend together.
Yeah, well, exactly. And I kind of like that.
Me too. It's a good approach.
Well, do we want to jump over to part two of this one? Any final thoughts on part one?
I did laugh quite a bit about the Hoshi dream sequence, or Hoshi talking about the dream.
Yeah.
And how it was tied to the T'Pol and Trip. Like meditation dream.
Oh, she's like, I never dream of Commander Tucker.
I wish he'd been in the room.
That would have been awesome.
And just, There's one part, though, that I don't know. It's kind of a trope that's a little awkward, which is the, we find out, Hoshi witnessed this attack on Phlox. She heard something, but she can't remember. So, T'Pol goes to do the mind meld, right? And Archer's like, I want you to do the mind meld. She's like, it's very dangerous. Archer's like, I don't care. Go ahead. But then there's like this trope of Archer being like, I'll talk you through it. I know it all. I had the Katra, which is like kind of like that awkward trope of like, you see it a lot in non-sci-fi of like the white character who's mastered other societies and explains it to them.
In Star Trek,
you remove a certain amount of that problematic element because we're talking about Vulcans, Klingons, whatever. But they've done this a little bit in the Vulcan arc, and then having him do it here, I was like, ooh, it's kind of a weird look.
It's kind of like their version of Iron Fist.
Sure. Yeah. Yeah, and it's something that I can't say like it bothers me or ruins the episode anyway, but I would have liked a little more of T'Pol taking the lead on that one in some way.
But keep in mind, though, mind melds in this era, like, Vulcans just didn't do them. Like, they, we had learned during the Vulcan arc, though, that it seemed as if mainstream Vulcan society did not want people to even be aware of this possibility as a power. They were calling people that could perform it a minority, which was kind of like, huh. So, yeah, there's some problematic elements in that, but I can understand why at that point, you know, he had to be the facilitator, because who else would have done it unless he was pulling Saval out of mothballs at that point to get him on that.
I am very curious if they would write that the same way now.
Tough to say.
Yeah.
I don't know. What would the option have been, though? How would you have approached that scene?
You bring in Saval? I don't know.
Okay. But well, keep in mind,
Saval.
Yeah, I know.
He doesn't do the mind meld
either.
Yeah,
he doesn't know how to do it.
No, I mean, it's definitely they wrote.
Bring in T'Pau.
Sure, T'Pau. Sure. Yeah, she gets on the view screen with T'Pau. That'd be great. I like that character.
There we go.
Yeah,
solved it. Yeah, solved all society's problems.
Well, that's another podcast done.
Kicking off with part two is just one of the most badass sequences we've seen in Star Trek Enterprise, maybe Star Trek period, where we have, of course, the cliffhanger was that the Klingon augments that had invaded the ship in part one that we kind of skipped over because whatever. But
they look cool.
They're interesting. Kind of
not a lot of character there in part one
or part two.
Yeah, well, a little more.
A little more. Yeah, but essentially there's a virus on the ship, and so the Enterprise kind of stuck going at warp, and Mr. Kelby couldn't get the job done, so they needed to bring in Trip to do a warp field tethered jump in between ships.
Okay, that part's really dorky.
It's so dorky, but, like, I love the sequence. Like,
oh, yeah.
It was just...
I mean, I remember seeing the movie Cliffhanger, where this looked really difficult to do between planes, and they made it look very simple, doing it between starships going at, like, warp speed.
Cam... I mean, I could do it. I mean, I don't know about you.
That tether is a heck of a device.
Yeah. But look, I love this sequence. We've never seen anything like that in Star Trek before. Could you imagine them even trying to attempt that during, like, the, I don't know, TNG era?
Okay, who's the one that goes across?
I think it's Riker.
Yeah, I think Riker as well. Okay.
Who would be number two, though? Who's...
Data, maybe?
Yeah, you know,
because you would have that, like, really calm assurance on his face while he does it. That could be a really cool moment.
He doesn't even need to wear the spacesuit.
No.
Like, that'd be another... That could be kind of a fun, like...
Or would he be, the number one choice to do it, maybe?
Maybe, yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. No, Riker's number one choice, and then he gets sucked away into outer space, and they're like, okay, Data, gotta be you.
Good thing that was secretly Thomas.
Ouch. So, yeah. But look... kick it off with this, and it's interesting here, though, because when we move more into the Phlox stuff that's going on, what I do appreciate this, though, is I think you and I thought that Phlox was never at his never had more to do than in season three, where he was really kind of Archer's conscious throughout all of this. And if you listen to what John Billingsley says at conventions, he talks a lot about how he had a lot of problems personally with the arc of season three, with how jingoistic it was as a response to 9/11. Mm-hmm. And I kind of get the sense that maybe they were channeling John Billingsley through the Phlox character in season three. I think he made his feelings known to the writers, and I think they did maybe whatever effort they could to channel that. And
do you mean, like, channel that into season four in terms of the writing?
No, I think it was throughout season three.
Oh, okay.
I think, like, John Billingsley's conscience was kind of being represented through Phlox in that.
And, yeah.
And I don't think Phlox ever had a better season. Mm-hmm. I think he seemed a little bit lost, like, way less to do in season four. And I think this might be just one of his kind of standout episodes here. The Augment arc had some interesting things going on there, too.
Yep.
But I just really like kind of where they push him and kind of the questions that he has to address in this arc.
Well, I think of that season one episode, Dear Doctor, which is such a fantastic episode. And it was a real bummer that they didn't pick up really and run with that Phlox character. Like, boy, he sure seems primed to do so. Like, he seems like a fantastic character. And I always thought it was really frustrating that... Look, he did get more to do than your Mayweathers, your Hoshis, so it's hard to complain too much for John Billingsley, because he definitely was at least probably number four.
I think
he's
most definitely number four.
Yeah, so, but it does feel like he's a character that could have driven a lot more stories than he did.
You also just look at John Billingsley's resume post Star Trek. I think he's the busiest actor. Like, I mean, if you take away, you know,
Bakula's pretty busy.
Bakula's NCIS, you know, credits, you know, like, but Billingsley is just kind of this go-to character actor that he pops up in like every third movie or TV series that you watch. I think he's got like this kind of innate quality to speak with some sort of like kind of confidence and authority while bringing a little bit of like interesting, like, I don't know if archness is what it is, but it's like there's just a little it factor to it where like
a little twinkle.
Yeah, he's not like kind of the bland sort of like exposition dump sort of guy that you sometimes see doing these same roles in TV show or movie or whatever.
And you see how he can really project that through the makeup, which is very difficult as well. And like, I love all the stuff in this episode with Phlox feeling this conflict and really like standing up against the Klingons to the point where they're like beating him up and whatever.
Yeah.
Because he will not go forward with, you know, they want to create these augmented Klingons. And I thought that was actually a really genius way to tie, if we're going to talk about, you know, having to rewrite the past of Klingon appearances, tying it to the augment stuff.
Yeah.
It was really smart to have, like, of course, why wouldn't the Klingons look at the augments and be like, well, hold on, we can be bigger and better warriors. Why wouldn't they do that? It makes a lot of sense from the psychology of the Klingons.
Are you bummed out that we haven't seen Denobulans pop up in Discovery yet? Or do you think that there's kind of the possibility for Denobulans to make an appearance down the road in another Star Trek series?
I would have to believe at some point they'll pop up. I don't know how prominently, though.
Yeah. You know, maybe in the background somewhere. But
yeah.
It's kind of a bummer to me because there's just some interesting stuff that even the Klingons bring up. You know, it's like three wives to, you know, three husbands and three husbands to three wives. And
yeah.
Think about all that intermixing. Still very heteronormative.
Right.
You know, but I'm sure there's layers that they just didn't get into on, you know, 2005 era television.
Oh, of course.
Although this is still 10 years after Ellen's coming out episode. Like, I don't know, Star Trek. Yeah. Star Trek's never been great with regards to LGBTQ representation.
This is also on, like, broadcast TV on
UPN.
So
is Helen.
Yeah, that's true.
I should say Ellen.
Ellen, yeah. But I would be very curious to see what it would be like maybe on a show like Discovery. If they decided to do the Denobulans,
yeah,
maybe we get a little more there that actually does touch on some different elements of their society that a broadcast show would be less likely to.
It'd be like that Emperor Georgiou scene in Engineering when she goes and talks to both Hugh Culber as well as Stamets. That was a great awkward what the hell was that sort of scene.
Well, they didn't shy away from Klingon love scenes, so maybe we would see something with the Denobulans.
Yeah.
So
there you go.
Yeah.
Are you saying you want Denobulan love scenes?
I'm not saying that I, you know, desperately needing them, but I'm saying that, like, Discovery would be more willing to explore that, like, maybe like facet of their culture.
Different sexuality,
yeah, sure,
like, representation and all that.
And to show it in a way that's not, like, awkward or also, like, cheeky. You know what I mean? Like, they presented it very matter-of-fact with the Klingon stuff. So, you know, who knows?
And I should also just clarify, it's not just to comment on the fact that you know, polyamory is accepted within that society. But I was also kind of pointing out that there doesn't seem to be any, like, homosexual, like, partnerships within Denobulan society, just based on what this Klingon was saying.
Sure.
I'm sure when the next Denobulans pop up, you know, we'll get more. We're getting into the weeds of it all. But
we are.
But the other thing that I thought was interesting, like, this one had kind of a sly allusion to Star Trek VI, The Undiscovered Country, where we have more of that Paris plotline continuing on, and we find out that he is working with the Klingon general, Krell.
I love Krell. Krell is just, he's a very one-note character in this episode, but I found him really fun.
He serves his function.
Oh, yeah.
He's like, yeah, you want to use that little inoculation on me that you don't know will work? Go ahead.
Yeah.
Yeah. You want to experiment on my son? Go ahead. He doesn't like to be played a favorite or anything like that.
Yeah.
You know, but we do find out that, look, there is collaboration going on between Starfleet and the Klingons. Once again, this is a thread. Mm-hmm. I guess this thread is obvious in Star Trek Discovery, too, because we literally have kind of a former Starfleet officer working with the High Chancellor of the Klingon Empire, and there's a lot of collaboration there too. It is interesting to see how this seems to be something that the Klingons and the humans are used to doing.
Yeah, and I really liked that we got that element of Section 31 wanting a stable Klingon Empire, which is something that you wouldn't have heard as much in, like, the original series. You're not going to have characters saying they want a stable Klingon Empire.
Yeah.
They don't really care.
I like it. It gives motivation to a character like Harris, who would otherwise be kind of like bland. And as you said, like when you're talking about Krell, like kind of one note.
Yeah.
So I dig this. So things get resolved here,
mm-hmm.
as they do on Star Trek. I'll take you to the scene that bugged me.
Okay.
We're in sick bay.
Yeah.
And we've got the Klingon doctor commenting, I don't have my ridges, but guess what? Maybe after decades of research, we can try to fix all those issues that have been created through all this. But for now, Klingon society will have to get used to something a little bit different.
Right.
And it's just beating the audience over the head with everything we know. And we're like, okay, we get it, guys. Yes, this is how Klingons look different now.
Yeah, I did like Archer with the ridges, though.
That was kind of funny.
Should he have kept those?
Yes. The rest of the season.
Series.
Yeah.
Had they gone into season 5, I want him still to have those ridges.
That's going to be my new cosplay for next year's Star Trek convention. Just subtle Archer ridges.
I wish they hadn't been subtle, though. Just go all out.
Yeah.
I want Discovery ridges on him.
Give him Klingon teeth while we're at it. Yeah. It's either that cosplay or I'm still down for the Anson mount with a bag over his head, a la the Short Trek Ask Not.
Yeah. Oh, yeah, of course. So what did you think of the resolution to all the Reed stuff with his conflicts
with
Archer?
He kind of got away easy, did he not?
He did.
Like all Starfleet officers seem to do when they disobey orders.
Yeah.
But I do like the fact that he's coming out and he's saying, look, my loyalty is with Archer. It's not with some special ops team that somebody recruited me for when I was like a young, impressionable ensign.
Mm-hmm. I really like the scene, too, where Archer says, like, how's your family going to feel about this? And you can tell, like, it's just, like, eating him up inside. He just has this, like, I don't know.
Yeah.
Like, he doesn't know. I like that the character never really breaks. Because a lot of times in these, you know, not just in Star Trek and other shows too, or movies, the characters will break and be like, okay, here's what's happening. I did this, I did this, I did this. And he never does.
Yeah.
He never has that moment of going, well, there's this thing called Section 31 I signed up for.
It's essentially like after like one scene, a character will be like, okay, you got me.
Mm-hmm.
But here it's really Archer comes down and kind of figures out what's been going on with this. And he wants answers there.
Yeah.
So, yeah, I like Archer being able to be smart and be legitimately pissed off with Reed, who, you know, like, I like a conflicted Reed with something to do, which we never really got to see enough of.
Yeah, usually when we talk about Star Trek two-parters, we kind of check in and point out how well they give everyone stuff to do. This one gave a lot of people stuff to do, but it was still pretty light on the Hoshi and Mayweather.
Yeah.
Hoshi got a little more. But Mayweather, not so much.
So the question we always ask when we get to these two-parters, Cam, is does this justify itself as a two-part episode? My answer, yeah. Yeah. I think if you want to tackle this question, which is why Klingons look different.
Yeah.
I think it's kind of smart that it's almost kind of like their B story to a certain degree. And it's the character stuff going on within the ship that is more of the A story that I'm way more engaged with.
Well, I'm very thankful, actually, that the Klingon stuff is kind of the B story, because a lot of it is the sort of dramatic storytelling that isn't enough of a hook to really hold me as an A story, where they tell you, we have an hour to solve this.
I know.
I go like, okay, I guess, well, if they say so.
Yeah. It's more the plot-based stuff versus the character-based stuff. Yeah.
But when you just tell me, like, we have 1 hour to do this, my response is like, okay, like what's an hour in TV time? Like that doesn't mean anything to me. It doesn't have necessarily the dramatic stakes right there in front of you until really the end when the Klingon ship starts shooting at the facility while they're trying to get things going. And so, and even the character John Shuck plays, who does get injected, we don't get him near his deathbed or anything like that. Like we have to save his life. So like, I like that. You know, even if they are a little short on the dramatic build of the actual virus solution, they don't focus the whole episode on it. We get really great stuff with Reed in Section 31, as well as, you know, Trip on the Columbia, so I can be invested in other stories. And I've also got this really fun, you know, continuity rewriting or fixing, I suppose, Klingon story.
Yeah, this one is kind of a fun one. Like, we would watch a lot of those Star Trek Voyager two-parters, mm-hmm. and I would forget that I actually liked Workforce back in the day. Like, Workforce is a stronger two-part episode than I remembered, and this, you know, the Affliction Divergence one is a much stronger two-parter than I remembered, and there's just fun elements. So for me, yes, totally justifies itself as a two-parter.
It justifies itself for me, too, in the story it's telling. I do think you could have done it in a one episode. You would maybe cut out the Columbia stuff or the Section 31 stuff. You could have done a Klingon augment virus story in one episode, but I'm more than happy with what we got with this more expanded character-driven stuff.
Yeah, you can cut out all the good stuff,
yeah,
and then we could just watch a boring Klingon virus one.
And you know that a different series would have done that.
I know.
And they would have gone, there you go.
Well, speaking of franchises that are building more lore for fans to explore...
You keep bringing up lore.
It is a word that existed before Star Trek, Cam, so yes.
Not as far as I know.
Yeah. Anyway, last week I introduced what we were then calling the Mandalorian Report for all those Disney Plus subscribers that are watching The Mandalorian. Cam has now caught up, and I think we're going to rebrand this, Cam. It's now going to be called the Camdalorian Report. So good luck to all those Disney Plus fans that want to have any clue what we're talking about.
Well, that's a great term for search function online.
Yeah, all that SEO.
Yeah.
Oh, man, people are going to be just like driving themselves over to our website.
Yeah.
But so we're, what, four episodes in?
Yeah.
I think what I said last week, I don't know, spoiler warning if you, I don't know, skip ahead like 4 minutes or whatever.
But, sure.
What I said last week for episode three is, you know, like... that was kind of the episode that really like sold me on The Mandalorian mm-hmm. being like this real
That's
fun.
That's episode The Sin, right? I think, yeah.
I don't know. But I don't know my Star Wars episode titles the same way I know my Star Trek titles. But I praised it for like its kind of the simplicity within the storytelling, and like I kind of knew what was going on. This episode four, though, it was almost too simple in its storytelling.
Yeah.
And it was just like to the point it was like cliched storytelling where it's just like
Seven Samurai. Yeah.
And it's like we've seen that before and other people have adopted it. And
Enterprise
just,
has done that, actually.
Well,
Was it Marauders? I think they did it as well.
It just seems super derivative watching this one. And it's like, so what am I actually getting out of episode four?
I think you get a really interesting character brought into it with Gina Carano's character. And some really great imagery with the AT-ST. I thought at night with like the red eyes. I thought that was pretty fantastic.
Yeah.
So
it just, you know, I think
some really cute Yoda moments
coming off. That's every single episode.
Yeah.
Yeah. But like,
come on, just, Baby Yoda playing with the kids was wonderful.
No. Baby Yoda playing with the controls in the, in the spaceship.
Yeah.
Have you seen the memes where like, they are Baby Yoda playing with stereo instead? So like music will come on and like, Mando has to like swat him away.
Yeah,
like
that's
been, making me crack up too. So, yeah, so I, what my question is, though, was episode three an anomaly, or was episode four more of just kind of a, they need to take a bit of a breather to a certain degree?
Well, when I look at the pattern so far, it seems like the odd-numbered episodes are very much like progressing the narrative of the show,
yeah,
and the even are sort of these mission-based action episodes, because in the episode two you had the Jawa stuff with the sandcrawler and then the retrieving the egg, and then in episode four you have the saving the villagers from the bandits and their AT-ST, and then it's like episode one and three are really pushing the character driven narrative stuff forward.
I was actually wondering why you came here with like orange yolk all over your mouth, but it all makes sense now.
Right. Yeah.
Okay. Yeah.
So I mean, if that's the method they want to go, that could work. Like, it'll be really interesting to see if that pattern holds true.
Yeah.
I have no idea at this point.
But I think we're on the same page. I think we both appreciate that the story is very simple to follow.
It is. It's
We're not as confused watching this as we would sometimes find ourselves confused watching Star Trek Discovery, where we're like, wait, what's going on?
Tracing the journey of Culber.
Yes, yeah. Which was like, huh?
Well, I love how much of it is just based on imagery and a lot of very classic Western tropes. Like, that's been a lot of the fun for me, is to spot the references back and forth. And throughout all the episodes, they've all touched on different stories I've seen.
Also, I didn't give it up to Ludwig Göransson, the composer.
I love that theme.
Like, he's doing, like, great, like musical scores for this, you know. So he's yeah. done some Marvel stuff in the past. He also did Community.
He does Ryan Coogler's movie, so he also yeah. did the Creed score, which was amazing.
He's also the Childish Gambino's like main musical collaborator as well. So it's kind of like the guy, very talented dude. So props to him.
Yeah. Oh, totally. I'm really enjoying this show, and I do like that it has a vibe that's kind of odd. Like, it feels different than most of the other shows out there.
Well, don't you think it's weird, okay, that Disney would allow this show to even be made? Like, this doesn't seem as if, like, what Disney would have in mind, but I should know better by now that Disney generally knows, like, how to really appeal to people.
Yeah.
But it's giving me a series that I didn't expect, which, you know, like, the stakes seem kind of low,
mm-hmm.
and I kind of like that. It just seems like an enjoyable and pleasant experience.
And
you know?
Pedro Pascal is doing a fantastic job, like, actually emoting through this bulky, cumbersome costume.
Oh, that's not actually him underneath the costume. It's I got a summer job, Cam, and he just came over, did the VO a few months later. So
I mean, back, you know, a couple years ago, Josh Trank was attached to do a Boba Fett movie. I have to wonder how much of that Boba Fett concept wound up being kind of evolving into this show. But at the time, I was like, you can't do a Boba Fett movie. Like, that just did not make sense to me. But The Mandalorian is kind of showing how you do that type of story with that character. I don't know that it would necessarily grab people as much in a two-hour block in a theater versus these nice, and I'm loving how the episodes are like 30 minutes
long. I know. That, but why doesn't more premium TV do that, though?
Yeah.
Like, you know, like there's some shows, they're like, yeah, let's do a special 72-minute episode.
Yeah.
It's like, okay. I mean, if you can justify it, go for it. But like, I do like how it's, you know, 30 to 40 minutes tops. So.
Yeah, totally. And yeah, I'm loving the energy of it. And I look forward to seeing where it goes.
Also, Carl Weathers doing the performance of his career as the wrangler for all the bounty
He's
hunters.
Great. Werner Herzog. I love that the casting is really weird.
Yes.
Gina Carano, an actress who's I've seen in quite a few things, Haywire, Deadpool. I think they got her like signed up for a really interesting character that will hopefully do more down the road. I don't know. The show's interesting. I'm looking forward to seeing how well thought out it was when we get to the end point, to see if we really have this tight 8-episode story.
Well, it's just weird because you're definitely more of the Star Wars fan than I am, but it explains so much to me now that I've never seen you without a helmet off.
Right. It's actually just a traffic cone.
Is that what it is? Yeah. I think I said helmet off. I ruined the joke. I meant helmet on. But okay. Listeners, you get it. Traffic cone Cam.
That's right.
Okay.
Okay. So I think on that note, our assignment is complete. If you enjoyed listening to this podcast, we want to hear from you. Jump on over to the Facebook page at facebook.com/subspacepod. Tyler, what are we doing next time?
We're doing the very strange and bizarre legacies of two Star Trek films that I think deserve some reconsideration from the fans. But we had the big 40-year anniversary of the motion picture, and we have, I guess now, the 20-year anniversary of Star Trek Insurrection. Sorry, Generations, we skipped your 25th anniversary a few weeks ago, but I think there is like a very interesting reason. You guys will find out why we're focusing on Insurrection and TMP specifically.
Mm-hmm.
It's going to be worth it, like, for us to kind of reframe why these are kind of significant movies in what we know about them. So definitely tune in for that.
And they won't just be your basic movie review episodes. We've done those.
We've done the reviews.
And we will post links to those reviews in the show notes next week.
So this is going to be something totally different. So even if, like, and I think the reason we're tackling these ones is because, generally speaking, like, a fan response is more muted towards these ones.
Well, these ones very much feed into that classic Trek thought pattern that fans have where, you know, the odd-numbered movies are the bad ones.
Yes.
Yeah.
So we can dig into why that perception might be and maybe why people can reconsider. Whether you like the movies or you don't, I think you'll get a lot of fun out of this one. And then, Cam, I think for the longest time, was not our motion picture episode, like, the most heavily downloaded episode that we ever did, our review episode?
It was very highly downloaded, that one. Yeah.
So maybe there are more fans out there than we ever expected.
More so than Wrath of Khan, which was a surprise to me at the time.
Yeah.
So I don't know. Okay. You can, of course, also find us on the Twitter. I'm at Cam V as in very excited to see a Targ Smith.
You can find me at Reportin. That's REP. P as in Patrick Stewart's head on an Ewok's body. OR. T-O-N.
Okay, so until next time, the arena is closed.